The following program contains graphic material, including offensive language. Viewer discretion is advised.
When Nicole Sandler sits down to do her show, she's the producer, booking the guests, pulling the audio, planning the show, the engineer, running the controls, troubleshooting any problems, playing the sounds, calling the guests, and she's the webmaster, writing the blog, posting the podcast, maintaining the website, not to mention the host, interviewing the guests, explaining the issues, giving opinions, and calling out the bad guys. And then you get the Nicole Sandler Show on NicoleSandler.com.
Phew. All right. Well, welcome to it. It is a Wednesday. All right, so we're right smack in the middle of the week. But that's okay, because this is a busy week for me, and I've been working on this program that's going to air Friday that's taking up a lot of time, and I need every minute of it. So anyway, welcome to today is the 2nd of February. Today's 2-2-2-2. 2-2-22. If you are a betting person, a numbers person, today might be a good day to bet the twos. Although maybe not, because the payout would probably be low because all the two people are betting on two today. 2-2-2-2. And let's see, when I logged into the chat room, the first message there was, the post was from Kameshwari Kate, who said, "Happy Imagine Peace Day." Is today Imagine Peace Day? It should, and somebody else suggested that every day should be Imagine Peace Day, and I'll take that. You know, today's show card invokes an old iconic image. I'm going to put it up on the screen again for those of you who can see it. For those who can't, it's the old poster that was everywhere in the 1960s. The war is not healthy for children and other living things. You know, it's so funny, when we were protesting the wars going on and potential wars over the last however many years, I made up a poster, a sign to carry, and I recreated that old poster. And there were some people there who had no idea that it was ever a thing, who just said, "Oh, that's cool. I like that." And then there were the others, people, you know, my age, who went, gave me the knowing glance. Ah, yes. And coming up today on the program, Katrina VandenHeuvel, who is the editorial director and publisher of The Nation magazine, to talk about what's happening with Russia. And she had the same reaction to that poster. I think when she came online, we had to tape it because she's tied up this afternoon. So we taped it not even an hour ago. So it's very fresh. We just got off. But while we're on, she had another appointment that she couldn't break. So we just taped it a little while ago. But when she saw the image, she said, "I haven't seen that in years." And I said, "Well, it just seemed appropriate for today." And she said, "Absolutely." So anyway, I don't like war. I hope we do everything possible to avoid it. That goes without saying. So we'll get to what's happening with Russia and Ukraine and American troops, 3,000 of them being deployed. Although Joe Biden says he's not going to send our young men and women into combat. So we'll hold him to that. Okay, what else? There's a lot of news today. Today was a busy news day, but it was the sort of unexpected news, like the breaking news that happened mid-morning. CNN President Jeff Zucker announced he's resigning, and I guess his resignation was immediate. It's over his failure to disclose a consensual relationship with a subordinate at CNN. Now, he was the boss, so I guess everyone's a subordinate, but the person that he was having an affair with is CNN's executive vice president and chief marketing officer, Allison Gullist. She apparently, at least as of now, is staying on. Here's the statement that Jeff Zucker put out. He wrote, quote, "As part of the investigation into Chris Cuomo's tenure at CNN, I was asked about a consensual relationship with my closest colleague, someone I have worked with for more than 20 years. He continued, "I acknowledge the relationship evolved in recent years. I was required to disclose it when it began, but I didn't. I was wrong." As for Gullist, She wrote a statement, Jeff and I have been close friends and professional partners for over 20 years. Recently, our relationship changed during COVID. She's remaining at CNN, but her statement continued, I regret that we didn't disclose it at the right time. According to CNN's Brian Stelter, news of Zucker's resignation left staffers inside the network in shock. The official line continues, says CNN leadership said news on a succession plan will come soon. Zucker has steered CNN since 2013, reshaping the network and shepherding it toward the streaming era. And it's making these huge investments into this new streaming channel, CNN Plus, which is set to launch this spring. Okay, so I don't know, you know, I don't know that anybody knows what will happen next. But that's what we're seeing from the, you know, the mainstream media. Now, Judd Legum, who has his own popular, I think it's called Popular Information, Substack newsletter, he has a thread on the Twitters. And let me just share with you what Judd Legum wrote just a few hours ago. Zucker is successfully spinning his firing slash resignation as a simple matter of failing to disclose a consensual relationship with a subordinate. But that's not the whole story. He says the woman who Zucker was in that relationship with was Allison Gullust, CNN's chief marketing officer. But one thing I'm not seeing mentioned is that before joining CNN, Gullust was the communications director for Andrew Cuomo. Why is this significant, he asks? Well, Zucker defended Chris Cuomo for months after it was revealed he was advising his brother Andrew on how to handle allegations of sexual harassment. He was allowed to keep doing his show. Now we know that Zucker made this decision while in an undisclosed romantic relationship with Andrew Cuomo's former communications director. That's why it came up during the investigation of Chris Cuomo. It gets curiouser and curiouser, you know. So, and he continues, Judd Legum continues. So Zucker's undisclosed relationship was far more significant. It not only was a breach of standard ethics, it compromised his ability to deal with Chris Cuomo's ethical breach. He continues, I've read a bunch of stories on this and I haven't seen anyone mention it. Personally, he said, I'd like to know what role, if any, Gullust had in influencing CNN's response to Chris Cuomo's conduct and if she had any discussions with Chris Cuomo's or others in how Andrew Cuomo should respond to the allegations. But wait, there's more. Then he quote tweets Matthew Bellany, who is, from The Hollywood Reporter. Okay. He's the founding partner. Oh, he's a former editor of The Hollywood Reporter. He's a founding partner at Puck News. Ah, and now I just lost my, damn it. That's what I get for opening that up. Hold on. Now I gotta find Judd Legum again. Damn it. That's what I get for clicking through. I should know better. Okay. So back to, let's see, Judd Legum's thread. Because there was more. He wrote more. Okay, so Matthew Bellany, he quote tweeted, who wrote, potentially important, I'm told CNN received a litigation hold letter recently from Chris Cuomo's lawyers, demanding, among other things, preservation of all communications between Zucker, communications chief Allison Gullust, and Andrew Cuomo. See how this is all coming together? Then he writes, to be clear, this is not, oh, that's a different thing. That was a different story. So, so that's interesting. And then there's an update. Update, this is what Gullust wrote to Andrew Cuomo when she resigned as his communications director in 2013 to join CNN. Quote, regardless of where I am employed, you will continue to have my unwavering allegiance as an advisor and, most importantly, a friend. Okay. You know what? Zucker got caught with his pants down. And let me just say, honesty is the best policy. You know, if all the rules at CNN said, or if you're going to stop a coworker, let HR know, they should have let HR know. You know? I know. All right. There's some other stuff going on. I'm seeing lots of things just breaking today, like this. January 6th committee subpoenas phone records from Arizona Republican Chair Kelly Ward and her husband. They've sued to block the release, but the case was assigned to federal judge Susan Brinovich, wife of Arizona Attorney General, under fire for failure to act on Republican election review. Oh, my God. This, you know, if we keep allowing the foxes to guard the hen house, we're never going to get anything figured out. I don't know how we how we get around it, because most people seem to align with one side or the other. And when someone says, "Nah, I'm kind of in the center, I don't really, you know, lean one way or the other," I have to call
bullshit,
because that's impossible. In today's climate, I don't see how anyone can be on the fence. Either you're for democracy or you're not. You know? I know. All right. So what else happened today? We could talk about the. I know what I want to talk about. You know me, I'm such a big sports person. By the way, the phone lines are open. Anything you want to talk about? We're going to hit the interview with Katrina in about 15 minutes. So we have time. But other news that broke today is, and this isn't really news, but, you know, I guess it is, because this nation is obsessed with football. And so the Washington football team today announced its new name. Did you hear this? I thought it was kind of interesting. I bet I didn't pull over the, damn it. I wonder if I have it here. I did record the audio of their big announcement. Here we go. I can play it right from here. So it went like, so NBC News cut live to the stadium in D.C. where, what's his name? Craig Melvin was on the field with three football player types. And this happened. This happened. this happened.
What is the new team name?
Doug, what is it?
We are the Commanders.
We are the Commanders.
The Commanders.
The Washington Commanders.
That's right.
The Washington Commanders. At first, I'm like, I don't get it. And then it all made sense. It all made sense to me. So if you're watching one of the video streams, check out this photograph. Photograph of an adorable German Shepherd puppy. And here is that same puppy walking into the White House, his new digs. His name is Commander. Uh-huh. And he's the Biden's new dog. So Dan Snyder, the owner of the football team formerly known as the Washington football team, and by an offensive kind of racist name before that for 80 some odd years, named the team for the new White House puppy. He's saluting the Bidens. Let's go, Biden. Let's go, Commander. Yay, team. I said it on the radio. It's got to be true, right? Isn't that how it works? you know, it's so funny because I was looking on my Twitter feed, as I tend to do throughout the day. By the way, I'm on Twitter at Nicole Sandler, just how it sounds, and feel free to follow me. And somebody whose screen name is Get Your Booster, Stay Masked, okay, Kathy Tack, who doesn't even follow me, who tweeted, I thought the new name for the Washington football team was weird until I heard Nicole Sandler remark, Commander is the name of the newest member of the POTUS FLOTUS family. So the Commanders are honoring our beloved first family. Huzzah! You see, you got to catapult the propaganda, to quote a former president. If you say something often enough, then people tend to believe it. I like how that works. Hi, who's this?
This is Proudskull.
Hey, Proudskull, how you doing?
I hope your new year started out fine.
You know, we're hanging in there.
Thank you for the the Children and Living Things poster brought back old memories.
Right. You know, a lot of people just forgot about it. And that poster has stayed with me all these years. And every time we hear the drumbeats of war, I throughout the years, I've thought of that. But it sort of disappeared from the collective consciousness. It's been gone for so many years that it blows my mind that there are people who've never seen it before. It was so ubiquitous, right? It was everywhere.
Mm-hmm. The kids should know about it.
Yes, and, they should.
Talking about kids,
yeah.
What's up with the DNC? I mean, they are all, the leadership basically is, the average age is 82 years old. You know, Clyburn's going to celebrate his 82nd in July.
Yeah.
And Feinstein, Pelosi, and Hoyer, they're all the same age. In fact, I looked up at Hoyer's bio. Did you know that he entered the Maryland State Legislature way back in 66?
I did not know that, but it makes sense. Nancy Pelosi has held her seat in Congress since 1987. I'm sorry. There comes a time when you need to turn over the reins to the next generation. This is their world now. We're just living in it, us old folks. It's time to let them take over and try to fix the mess we left them with.
The last generation was not that culturally diverse either. That's another very big issue.
Yep, that's true. That's true. So, not only that, but did you hear what happened? What's his name? One of the senators, and I'm drawing a blank now on who it is, from New Mexico, Ben Ray Lujan, had a stroke. Mm-hmm. Now, they say he'll recover fully, but guess what? He's out of commission now for a good amount of time. He's got to recuperate. He had a stroke. That leaves the Senate, the Democrats, with only 49 votes to confirm anyone, to pass any legislation. Their hands are tied until Ben Ray Lujan can come back and resume his responsibilities as a senator. This is terrible.
And that it also points to why we need more Democratic governors, because if Lujan is incapacitated, the governor would appoint a new senator.
The governor of New Mexico. That's right. That's right. Now I think the New Mexico has a Democratic governor, but don't quote me on that. I'm not sure. I don't know.
Thank you very much for your show.
Oh, well, thank you for listening, Proud Scal. I hope things are okay there in Alabama. That's the response. I hope things are okay there in Alabama. Click. Yeah. I get that. All right. Let's see. All right. Well, you know what? We're going to do this. Let me share with you the news story about, you know, the announcement of troops going to Eastern Europe. Okay, they're not being deployed to Ukraine or to Russia, but 3,000 U.S. troops will deploy to Eastern Europe's David has something to add. Yes?
The governor of New Mexico is Michelle Lujan Grisham.
Oh.
She is a Democrat.
Okay, good.
So
that's good to know.
He should resign anyway.
Yes, he should.
So someone else could take his seat and be able to cast votes. But, you know.
Without a doubt.
We know he probably won't.
No, he won't.
Until his corpse rots.
That's right. Along with the geriatric wing of the Democratic Party, which unfortunately these days seems to be a majority of it. Anyway, all right, so 3,000 U.S. troops will deploy to Eastern European NATO allies in the coming days amid ongoing Russia-Ukraine tensions, the administration announced today. The shifts, quote, are temporary moves intended to reassure NATO allies. Okay. According to this report, about 1,000 troops currently in Germany will head to Romania, while another 2,000 or so at Fort Bragg, North Carolina, will go to Poland and Germany. Another development. The White House is no longer using the word imminent to describe a potential Russian invasion of Ukraine because it was sending an unintended message. That's what Jen Psaki said. So there's a reversal. But, you know, look, the way these leaders or alleged leaders speak, and not only the leaders, the media, the way everybody talks about it, it has consequences. And that's also one of the things that Katrina and I spoke about. So you know what? Let's not wait any longer. I've got her on tape. So yeah, I know Lujan is not very old, so he's not going anywhere. And they say he's, you know, he's going to, you know, that he's going to recover, make a full recovery. The question is, how long is it going to take? Because we don't have time to spare. All right. So let's not waste any time. I hope this works. Let's move on to Katrina Vandenhoevel. Katrina Vandenhoevel, she's the editorial director and publisher of The Nation magazine. Katrina, it's always great to see you, and I always appreciate your time and expertise. I hate, though, what we're talking about today, because it looks like we're on the precipice of war once again. Now, you actually know a bit more about Russia than the average person over here. Your late husband, Stephen F. Cohn, was a professor of Russian studies at Princeton and NYU. He wrote for The Nation a lot on the subject, and you've written or edited a lot of works dealing with Russia, past and present. So you have a new op-ed in the Washington Post. It's also excerpted in The Nation. And the headline reads, "The Exit from the Ukraine Crisis That's Hiding in Plain Sight." And you refer to the Minsk II agreement, but we should probably back up and start with what's going on over there.
Well, there's history here. There's also very much the present moment, Nicole. And part of what is so dangerous is I think we sit here, probably the most dangerous U.S.-Russian conflict since the Cuban Missile Crisis in 1962, if you're listeners. I mean, we know about it. We may not have lived through it. But
we were babies then.
Two nuclear superpowers. The danger here, I think, is blunder, stepping into something accidental. Not that there aren't troops being sent today, as we know, from the United States, I believe the 82nd Airborne and Fort Bragg, to countries ringing Ukraine, the East European countries. But I do think more dangerous, because those may be bargaining chips to move Russian troops off the Eastern Ukrainian border, are the weapons. You know, sometimes they're called non-lethal aid or lethal aid. I don't know what that is, except they're weapons. And they've been shipped into Ukraine, not just in these last months, but for years. And I think in the last few months, 2.2 billion. And they're advisors, U.S. advisors in Ukraine training. And the idea is, you know, no president, American president, Nicole, is going to send American men and women. Biden has already said that. Ukraine is not a vital national security interest of the United States. I mean, it's a deeply asymmetrical situation, because for Russia, there's intermarriage, there's history, there's culture. But I think what we may see is an insurgency. I mean, there's some looking at funding a Ukrainian insurgency. Let me just say and step back, I will come to Minsk, but you need a political diplomatic resolution. The Europeans are playing a more focused role. But the idea of sending weapons and funding an insurgency, Nicole, after we've exited, and I think it was the right thing to do, exiting Afghanistan, how we did it is a different issue. And I would just footnote, you know, America, according to the Cost of War Project at Brown University, we spent almost $6 trillion over the 20 years we were occupying the country. Yeah. And now the humanitarian crisis in Afghanistan is such, we can't even pony up the international community $5 billion. Wow. So I think, you know, we got to remember the human costs of war, because if there is a war or a conflict or an accidental trigger, you know, I think refugees, thousands of refugees, it's just unimaginable. And 15,000 civilians have already been killed in Ukraine. So there is an offer. It was a peace process that launched in 2015 and was endorsed by the EU and the UN. Samantha Power at the UN, then the ambassador to the UN, said it was the only possible way forward. Of course, there was not enough trust. The separatists in eastern Ukraine wanted Ukraine to stop fighting, Kiev to stop fighting them. The Ukrainian leadership in Kiev reneged. It was a different time, though. I mean, I think the real fundamentals of this agreement, in two words, it's to have an independent Ukraine, sovereign borders, but also that within a federation, you have autonomy for the eastern Ukrainians and language rights, for example, but that Ukraine is whole and Russians are out. Mm-hmm. And it doesn't go to NATO. This is the big, all right, I'll say two more sentences. The original sin was NATO expansion. Mm-hmm. 1997, it expanded 13 countries. It's now at 30. It was on Russia's, it's on Russia's borders now. There was a promise to the Russians when Germany reunified in 1990 that NATO would not move one inch eastward. Huh. Promised by George H.W. and Baker, James Baker. This, of course, was quickly reneged on. And I think there is still NATO expansion, particularly 2008, Ukraine and Georgia is the deeply relevant issue here. But, you know, there's new leadership in Ukraine. The former leader has flown into Kiev in the last week and been indicted.
Oh, wow.
He is the chocolate oligarch, Poroshenko. So there's possibility, because in 2015, and I'll stop, you had Poroshenko, who's been indicted. You had Merkel, who was playing a positive role, but the government in Germany may play an even more positive role, the new government. The French president seems to want to be de Gaulle, which is great, which means more independent space from the United States. And then Russia, I think if you could work out, you know, different, more, the big issue is moratorium. If you can work out a moratorium on NATO expansion, bringing Ukraine in to say 10, 15 years, and the charter of NATO wouldn't even permit Ukraine to join at this point because of the mandates around territorial integrity and the economy. So there's a history here. Our media has made it like it happened yesterday. It's been right. going on for years.
Right, for like 40 years, right? I mean, this has been going on for a long time.
Certainly since the end of the Soviet Union in 1991.
Okay.
So 30 years.
30 years. Yeah. You know, I have this map here. I think this was from the New York Times. It'll show up on the screen. You know, a lot of people over here, for a number of reasons, don't understand the geography. But, when you see it, it's Ukraine is a big country. They have been independent since the breakup of the Soviet Union. But they've been fighting for their sovereignty. And what is Putin saying? That all he wants is an assurance that they will not be brought into NATO? That is,
that's the essential piece. Because of, you know, there is this, maybe it's obsolete and we should have a new kind of sense of global politics for the 21st century. But this idea of spheres of influence, which, you know, the United States, 1823, the Monroe Doctrine, we've had our spheres of influence. It played a role with Cuba.
Sure.
But the main thing is Ukraine, that its borders be sovereign, that it be free, but that it respect Eastern Ukraine, which for decades has been Russian speaking. Mm. And, you know, this is a civil war, which has become a proxy war, which has become a geopolitical conflict of enormous proportions. People do ask, why shouldn't a country have a right to join NATO? I think, by the way, Ukraine was going to join the EU. And the president then stepped back at the time and said, this is not a good deal because the EU is not a great instrument by itself, but it comes in and slashes subsidies, for example, for food or for oil. And it could have been dangerous in terms of an uprising around the economy. But Ukraine is a free, independent country with a great history, difficult history in some ways around World War II. But NATO is not a coffee clutch. NATO, when the Soviet Union ended, it had a counterpart to NATO called the Warsaw Pact.
Okay.
Warsaw Pact ended. The countries in the Warsaw Pact slowly moved to NATO. And NATO is not free. You have to, many of these countries have to prove their weapons are compatible with the Western countries' weapons. So there's a lot of lobbying and money at the root of this. And I have to say, I'm not a pacifist, but I do think, you know, we are in a time when we have such crises, Nicole.
Oh.
Other countries do, too. I mean, we're going to first, we should not have the defense budget we have. It's obscene.
And by the way, Russia, for you.
Obscene. And pandemics, climate crisis, inequality, racial division. So I'm just saying. Yeah. And by the way, the other piece of it is the nuclear. The nuclear arms control regime, so to speak, has been rolled back, dialed back. It is as weak as it's been in the last 30 years. And it should be rewoven.
Right.
And
didn't Trump pull us out of a nuclear, you know, cooperation agreement, a treaty of some sort?
I will tell you, he was there's one man who got off like a bandit, who was involved in the most serious arms control disaster, which was in 2002 under George W. Hmm. You remember John Bolton?
How could I forget?
So John Bolton, under George W., withdrew the United States from the Anti-Ballistic Missile Treaty.
Right.
This was the foundation. Then there was withdrawal from START this and this. And finally, Trump took us out of the Open Skies Treaty.
Right, that's it.
You know, and I will say, though, that under Reagan and Gorbachev in 1987, and partly due to movement pressure, an entire class of nuclear weapons was abolished, the INF. But right now we're in a precarious place. Nuclear proliferation, very dangerous, and U.S., Russia, not in an arms control frame. So.
Right. No, it's frightening what's going on. And I got to tell you, I'm not a great student of foreign relations, of international treaties and stuff. But, you know, I relate everything to my personal life. And I don't know if you know, I adopted my daughter from Kazakhstan back in 2000. So I was over there. And obviously the problems they had there a couple of weeks ago, I was very, very interested in, because those people I feel like are family. I spent a month over there, which is not very long in the scheme of things, but that's where my daughter is from. And so I watch what goes on in that region. And I went to Moscow because we had to go out through the American embassy there back 20 years ago. And I remember thinking how Western it was. I walked through Red Square. Moscow, you know, Red Square is now a shopping mall.
This is trivial, but what you're saying is so important, because I think most people relate, partly because Moscow was part of my life, and I have many friends there. I speak bad Russian, but I've been going since 1978.
Wow.
And when I first went, I didn't even speak, and everything was like Pektepal restaurant. But you know, they have a Zagat's guide now, Nicole.
Really?
They have department stores which make Barney's like slacking time.
That's awesome.
So I mean, there's a lot of wealth. There's a lot of inequality. The former president of Russia, a man named Medvedev, spoke the other day and said poverty was one of their central issues.
Huh.
And you think of things we could collaborate on, not easily, but on, you know, the nuclear arms control. And the embassies are virtually shut down, partly for economic reasons, but they've fueled the political problems. Embassies are critical. My Russian friends can't even get a visa right now because it's so backlogged. And so they're human. I think for many people, they want peace and stability. Trade issues have always been a foreign international issue that people relate to. I think the militarization of our foreign policy has come home in ways that people are linking to and, you know, looking at more carefully. And I think just the waste, you know, the U.S. budget, military budget, and NATO's combined is 20-fold more than Russia's. And the bases, you know, all these things. Now, there are good things going on. There are movements. There are people waking up. But we have a long curve and a lot of work.
Right. So if I understand correctly, Katrina Vandenhoevel is with us. That Putin's concern is that he doesn't want to see Ukraine join NATO.
That's the central concern. And by the way, I want to point out, our media often, it seems it has a key on the computer. Putin, I have no brief for. He's a soft or not soft authoritarian. And the situation inside Moscow is repressive at this moment, made more repressive for media and other independent groups, I think because of Cold War atmosphere. I mean, we threw out RT, foreign agent registration. I mean, you get tit for tat and hawks ascend. But Putin has a blob of his own. That expression, you know, the foreign establishment, foreign policy establishment. He is not the most extreme. I mean, there are people who would have gone into Ukraine earlier.
Right.
There are people in the east of Ukraine who are like the Russian separatists who would like to be a separate country. Mm-hmm. So all of that could move, but it's been held back, and one hopes it is.
Now he's insisting that war is not imminent. And in fact, I believe our policy now, they've softened the rhetoric because of those protestations, which is good. Is the drumbeat to war coming from us or from them?
Good question. You know, it's interesting inside Moscow, which I follow more carefully, but in the regions, my friends say, my Russian friends, that it's not like another issue, but Crimea in 2014, there was a lot of mobilization. The TVs were sort of mobilized. Right now, there's a lot about COVID. Mm-hmm. There's about poverty. It's not as mobilizing. And sure, there are some pundits like we have ours. But the concern I have is about this country, because Biden has been talking diplomacy. And the president of Ukraine has said that he's worried about some of the extreme language, bellicose language out of this country, right? Because it's freeing their economy. And the reporters, Nicole, so many of the reporters who, for example, at the press conferences, I remember the run up to Iraq, there were no serious questions. And the questions right now are like, when are you going to go to war?
Oh,
I mean,
man.
Literally, it's kind of in that framework. And I don't think that's helpful, because questions frame the responses. So there should, but I do take hope that Putin is meeting with the French president.
Mm-hmm.
There are calls. Lavrov and Blinken are talking.
Right,
the Finnish president is trying to try to play a role. So Europe is more assertive in trying to play that card. So we'll see. But the media is eager. And, you know, our timeline, because of Twitter and everything, is like, why not today?
Right.
So like, why isn't it started? You know, we're diplomacy takes time. If it, you know, we don't have a lot of time, but it takes time.
Right. And you know, I'm looking for this clip. I can't find it, but I can tell you what it was. It's probably better to do it that way than to play Tucker Carlson's voice. But, you know, he doesn't understand that at least Ukraine is a democracy and that Russia is an authoritarian
country. There's not much nuance, to say the least, because, you know, you got to call it like it is. But Ukraine has a lot of issues. I have a colleague, Lev Galinkin, was an emigre from Ukraine, 7 years old. He wrote a wonderful book about a crate of vodka and a teddy bear in a barrel. But he follows the far right in Ukraine. Oh. And there's a history. I mean, the Azov battalion has SS patches on their shirts. And I think part of the new president's problem is they are very powerful, these constituencies, the extreme right. So he doesn't have as much of a constituency, but it's troubling. But, you know, the Eastern Ukrainians, that was a mining community. And I find this an interesting story. It was told by Fiona Hill, of all things, who was an advisor to Trump and a Soviet Russia expert. She lived in a mining town in Britain. And the miners in Britain were in hard times, I think, because of Margaret Thatcher. And the miners in Donbass were doing quite well in the early 80s, and they would send goods and food to their counterparts, like an act of solidarity, minor to minor. I think I used to be more skeptical about citizen diplomacy, but I do think there's a role at some point, because as your poster, I love, you know, wars are not good for all of us.
Yes.
Women.
Yeah, that was everywhere back in the 60s when, you know, when we were kids. War is not healthy for children and other living things. And, I was shocked that I posted this some not too long ago. And a number of people, it's like, wow, that's a great poster. I've never seen that before.
Well, listen, everything comes back around. And I think, you know, that's why some history, some context, not to be too pedantic, but without that context, it's very tough.
Mm-hmm.
And and I think there's been an unwillingness. I covered Moscow in many different dimensions, women's groups, independent media, the rising protests in the early 80s, the Gulag Memorial Group. But it's a multifaceted, multicolored country. But for us, so often we personify, and Putin's become the basic, you know, Russian metric. And that's been difficult, too, because of demonization. I think you don't have to condone in any way, but it's worth trying to understand, and then you can demonize. But demonization leads fairly quickly to the ability to conduct war without much obstacle.
Right. You know, a few minutes ago, you mentioned our military budget. And correct me if I'm wrong here, we withdrew from Afghanistan, a country we occupied for 20 years. So you would think that when they do the next budget, the military share of that could be less because we're no longer there.
But Nicole,
they allotted more.
Do you remember when the Soviet Union ended? Where was the so-called peace dividend? Suddenly it was like more.
Yeah.
There was always something.
Always more.
More.
They never give back anything that they, and by they, I'm talking about governments, right?
I don't fully believe that it's all the military industrial complex, but there was a story last week. There was a conference of the big four corporations, and they were pleased with this. You know, they said it's a good time for us. It's like, remember Les Moonves of CBS News? This may be a bad time for the country about Trump, but it's good
for us. Yeah. Well, you know, and that's the problem. I mean, I have my problems with the corporate mainstream media. It's not the problem that the political right has. I don't distrust everything they say, but they are in it for it's clickbait. They are in it for the ratings. And maybe we need to go back to the time before the news division of any network was part of the profit center. It was a loss leader. It was not supposed to make a profit. And maybe we need to go back to that, because what we have now is not working.
Well, last I checked, the airwaves belong to the people.
Well,
you got it. But we did our first centerfold, if you can believe it, at The Nation in 1996. And it was called The National Entertainment State. And it was for octopi, you know, and it was like you could see the news operations were small cogs in major corporations.
Mm-hmm.
It's difficult. And we need a public media that is powerful, even if there's a private one. But
we do, but we also need, and I hate to say we need a return to the fairness doctrine, but we kind of do. We also need a governing body that has authority. As it is, the FCC has authority over the public airwaves, as you mentioned. That does not include cable or the internet. So if Fox put its network on television, they could not call it news. But because it's on over-the-air television, but because it's on cable, they can. And that's a huge problem, because there are millions of people who believe the stuff emanating from Fox's programs is news, because they say it's news and it isn't.
I just want to say I welcome your voice, because I think even more than Fox, the regional radio, right-wing radio.
Oh, my God, it's the worst.
And regional. We don't really listen. I don't, you know, and I think that's playing a huge role.
Terrible. And down here in South Florida, Spanish language radio is even worse. And I know there are Democrats who speak Spanish, but I don't think anyone is tasked with monitoring what goes over their air every day.
That's a
because
good point.
It's blatant lies. And I've seen, you know, Jim DeFede is a CBS reporter, is a friend of mine, and he's done a number of stories on this. But I don't think, you know, the fact that the Democrats fell in so much in the last election in Miami-Dade County, directly on Spanish language radio.
I'd love to be in touch with your friend.
Oh, I can put you in touch with him. Absolutely. I'll introduce you in an email. Without a doubt. Okay. Absolutely. Yeah, Jim DeFede wrote for the Miami Herald for years. He and I worked with him at WINZ on a progressive morning show. And then he went over to Channel 4, the CBS-owned station in Miami, where he's been for years. So he knows the landscape down here, and he knows all about what's happening with Spanish language radio. But again, and the FCC does have jurisdiction over radio, but the way it works, someone has to record it. And then provide a transcript and point out exactly what was wrong, and then the FCC will investigate.
And if you think about the state of news media, there's not a lot of excess to do that kind of work.
So Katrina, in your op-ed, you wrote about the Minsk II agreement. And is that what you're talking about, that that could be the way out?
It is the most possible. It is a true alternative combined with possible moratoria on NATO expansion and Ukraine being non-aligned, as, you know, Finland has been, or Austria.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, to be a bridge between East and West, so to speak. But the Minsk agreement was the one that was really endorsed by the UN and the EU, and Samantha Power at the UN thought it was the most possible. And I just don't think we give up on a process that has some potential at this stage, because otherwise, you know, you got to keep working. And I do have some hope that the diplomacy is revving up and that it's the bargaining chips, as I said, are the troops heading there, which is not hopeful. But
no,
there should be a moratorium on weapons shipments, too, because the blunder, the accidental blunder, is, I think, more frightening than planned incursion or invasion.
Without a doubt. Without a doubt. And look, we are just scratching one of the many pillars coming off of this thing. We haven't even gone into, I mean, I interviewed Peter Strzok the other day, and I had to play the clip from Helsinki when Trump is standing there next to him and calls out Peter Strzok for his appearance before the committee. It was just astounding. He's such a petty little man, and he's doing this on the stage, the world stage, with Vladimir Putin. You got to wonder what is going on there.
But I will say what is depressing is Trump is, he's not gone. I mean, he's, there's, you know, there's no longer just vote suppression. There's subversion of the vote. There's liberal anti-democratic activities in our country. We have to get our own democracy in order. But, you know, his policy, Biden's policy at the moment, talking Southern Florida, South Florida, toward Cuba is as bad or worse. There are more sanctions right now on Cuba. And the Iran deal, which should have been a no-brainer, is in limbo. So there's a feeling that we need to reset a foreign policy for the 21st century that is more sane. I don't know if it's left or right, but it's more restrained. It's not about America as the triumphalist, indispensable nation. It's America being part of a world community. Hmm. And I worry sometimes because there's a feeling America's on in decline. I think there are enormous problems everywhere. But if your decline is not managed with a sense of dignity, it can be dangerous. And I think there's a lashing out to show we're still so powerful. But I don't think military might is a measure of power or strength, certainly at this time when a lot of good nuclear weapons are going to do against the pandemic.
Right. Well, that's the other part. Again, these are the different tentacles. We are, our fall from grace from the world leader didn't come about gradually or with honor. It came about because of Donald Trump, because we had a madman who rose to lead this country and he embarrassed us on the world stage. And now with the lying about what's really happening and the lies about our election integrity and everything, I can't understand how the world would look up to the U.S. as a leader right now. They have to be thinking we can't depend on them, because while they may have returned to some semblance of normalcy, although I hate that word, it's so precarious. It could change again very quickly and all bets are off.
Yeah.
It's so a scary place.
It's a precarious time, but we got to keep, I don't know if it's optimism, but keep hope alive. Because there's work to do. And I worry sometimes that the media, a lot of the media in this country, listen, I love watching, I'm watching The Marvelous Mrs. Maisel. I never saw
it. Oh, it's great, isn't it? The new season, I'm waiting for the new season.
But a lot of our media, especially news media, it seems to me, is about making viewers spectators, not participants.
Hmm. Oh, interesting.
You know, and I think people should be engaged in what they want to be, but engaged. But I think there's sometimes a sense of paralysis that people can't do anything. And I think movements are important. COVID was difficult and there's fraction and factions, but still, I'm going to do something I hope later with the Progressive Caucus today. And I admire Pramila Jayapal. I admire many of the people in that caucus.
Me too.
They've come out of movements, but they're, you know, the fact that we have two people holding up what we need is so infuriating. And it's just...
It's depressing, and not only depressing in terms of our mental health, but in terms of our enthusiasm. You know, I know there are more of us than there are of Trumpers, for instance, but they're a lot louder and they're a lot more engaged right now. And we have to
strategic in ways.
Yes.
Like the court. Oh, the court. Aye. Well, fortunately, we were going to do a cover 3 days before Breyer resigned. Like, resign Stephen Breyer, you know. But
yeah. And so much of this is I'm not a sports person, but it's what, a forced error? Unforced error. It was a mistake. It didn't have to happen. It's just the Democrats are not doing the best job they could be doing. It's frustrating all around. You know, again, the tentacles are not, it's not just COVID. It's not just Russia. It's not just Trump.
No. It's a whole framework. It's a whole. It's a very difficult. I mean, the COVID overlay. You could just begin with that,
yeah,
and how that has set so much back. Though people are rethinking. I mean, but it's a global phenomenon that we don't fix on the global piece as much as we should. But the numbers and this, yeah, and I continue to believe that the mask issue is a proxy. You know, I mean, or the vaccines are a proxy.
Mm-hmm.
I won't get going, but it reminds me of how to get seatbelts in cars, mandated seatbelts, took many years. Wasn't easy. And it was Ralph Nader and Joan Claybrook, but then it was Elizabeth Dole, who was the Republican Transportation Secretary, who really moved it. But she did partly because she was trying to preempt legislation on airbags, which were going to cost the corporate. It's always, but you know, my daughter once said to me, how did we get seatbelts? And that's an interesting, you know, it's an interesting story. Nothing out of, you don't get nothing out of nothing. There's a history.
Sure. It's crazy. And people that should know better, people that I've known for years, some of them are pushing back on the vaccine. And I just don't understand it. Neil Young and Joni Mitchell are pushing back on Joe Rogan. They both fought polio as children. Without the polio.
I saw that.
Right?
That was so interesting.
And people don't remember. Or they choose not to know. Our immediate
those
past.
Have been very powerful stories, like out of, you know, the iron lung.
Yep.
And those stories. And to think that we have a vaccine and that it's not on use for so many after. So I did not know that. There's someone else. Anyway.
Yeah. We could keep going for hours. And Katrina VandenHeuvel, I so appreciate you. I mean, there's right now, there's so many different directions we could take this conversation. I know you've got to run. Yeah. But, you know.
I always enjoy talking to you, Nicole. So I'd love your friend's number too.
I will. I'm going to put you guys in touch via email. I'll do that right now when we finish up here.
Thank you.
Without a doubt. And yes, you're anytime, Katrina, you're always welcome here. I love talking to you. And thank you for writing this. And thank you for sharing your expertise on Russia, because I know a lot of people here have opinions,
so
but they're not based on
anything. Daughter.
Yeah.
I've never been to Kazakhstan. I mean, it was, yeah, that's a different discussion.
It
I have someone writing about what's happening there right now.
Well, I'll send you, I was on the radio in Los Angeles at the time when I adopted her. So yes. I kept an online journal. I'll send you a link to it because it's on my website now. So anybody can read it, but it is fascinating. And I've reached out, I've met some people in Kazakhstan online since then, and I worry about them. You said something. I've done this throughout the years. Whenever there's a conflict, when the Arab Spring was happening, I called hotels around Tahrir Square, and I called to hotels because there's usually someone who speaks English anywhere in the world, and I spoke to people there and just got their opinions. I called Israel and just called a hotel in Tel Aviv and had the best conversation with someone when it looked like Netanyahu was defeated the first time. I think
it's
when
so,
we
it's so important to get just even a sense of what's yes. happening on the ground.
And when you talk human to human and you take the governments out of the equation, it's a whole different thing. I've called Iran. Wow. I'll tell you, we can do this. We can connect with human beings in other places. And I think we need to do more of that.
I agree.
Katrina okay. Vandenhuvel, thank you so much.
Very
we'll talk soon.
Talking.
You too. Bye-bye. Thank you so much. She's great. Katrina Vandenhuvel, we could have kept going. We actually recorded that this afternoon. I think we got online together after 3:30. So she had a thing to go to, I think, with the Progressive Congress. She said she had something with them later today. Anyway, yeah, I hid Tree Amigo. We've got, it's interesting. The chat room, the YouTube chat room is kind of hopping today. And there are trolls. Now, I'm fully on board with timing out or banning the trolls. But if you come into the chat room and you have a difference of opinion, I think you should be allowed to express that opinion. It's all in the tone. And if you come in trolling and saying that that their opinion is the only valid one, that's not okay. If you're willing to have a respectful exchange of ideas and opinions, that's something else. So anyway, I want a variety of voices. I don't want trolls coming in and saying the vaccines just simply don't work. I'm vaxxed, but they don't work. They do work. They're keeping people from dying. The reason that the people who are catching it, it's not because they're vaccinated. It's because too many people didn't get vaccinated, which allows it to morph and spin off these variants. And that's why these variants come. There's a new Omicron. It's called Stealth Omicron. And it's even more communicable than the first Omicron, which was pretty fucking contagious. So, but the good news is it doesn't seem to be more virulent. It doesn't seem to make you sicker. But the reason that people who are fully vaccinated are catching it is because too many people are not vaccinated, and it's letting these variants morph. That's what viruses do. They try to find a way to survive. And by people not getting vaccinated, they're able to. Don't say the vaccines don't work. If everybody got vaccinated, the vaccines would work. Period. End of story. I'm so sick of these people deciding that I don't need it. Well, yeah, you do, because you're part of the community. You want to be part of our world community? Then get with the program and protect your fellow citizens. But because so many didn't and won't, we are going to be living with this virus for the rest of our lives and for the rest of, I believe, life on this planet. It's not going away. The reason we have the flu, the standard H1N1 flu, is because of the 1918 Spanish flu. That's the H1N1, the basic flu that we get a vaccine for, you should, every year, was directly, is an ancestor, or it grew out of that 1918 flu, or as Trump would say, the 1917 flu. So Omicron might be the end of it because we're surviving it. And the ones who are dying are the ones who haven't been vaccinated. What is so difficult to understand here? I just don't get it. I don't get it. All right. No, we will never be done with it. That's all. All right. With that, we're coming up on the end of the hour. While I've got a moment here, let me say that, Valentine's Day is a couple of weeks away, and you know what makes a great Valentine's Day gift? A custom pet portrait. So I can paint your pets, or perhaps you'd like a sun cut. I'm almost done with a standalone website for the paintings. So, I'm just delayed a little bit because I'm putting a lot of work into this special show we're doing on Friday. Friday, we're going to take a trip in the Wayback Machine again. Friday marks the 25th anniversary of the day Well, the LA Times headline was "The Day the Music Died." It was the day that this radio station, this amazing radio station that I worked at from 94 to 97, went off the air. We were sold. We were a casualty of the Telecommunications Act and consolidation. And the most adventurous creative radio station in LA was a casualty of that. So I'm doing a sort of reunion tribute show on Friday. So I hope you'll tune in for it. It'll be off topic here, but we'll have fun. I think you'll enjoy. We're going to have a lot of special guests calling in. And if you're a Foo Fighters fan, you should listen. All right. That's on Friday. All right. David, what?
You know what else makes a great Valentine's Day gift?
What? Yes. Oh, that's, yes. I painted that one for you. Okay. So David's showing one of my paintings. It's the lovers in the rain under the umbrella. Oh, he came in to show the painting I did. That one hangs in our bathroom, just in case you're wondering. All right. So tomorrow is Thursday. Howie Klein will be here, and then Friday again. You'll get a slice of my life. We're going to be joined by I'll tell you who it is. Rami Jaffe. Because we're in overtime now. Rami Jaffe was the keyboard player for the Wallflowers when I first met him. You know, Jacob Dylan's band, the Wallflowers. It was their second album, actually, but the first one to have a hit with, not One Headlight. That was one of them, but Sixth Avenue Heartache. That's when the station was on the air, and we broke that, you know, record. And Rami Jaffe became a dear friend of mine. Well, now Rami is the keyboard player for Foo Fighters. he's been in the band probably for 10 years now. Go figure. Anyway, he's among the artists that we used to play who's going to call in. I'm going to be joined by some of my former coworkers. We'll hear from some listeners. I'll have some air checks, some samples of, you know, it's going to be a fun hour. And, you know, if you don't want to listen because you just want the politics, I get it. But, you know, I hope you join us because it'll be fun. All right. With that, we're done. I will see you tomorrow. Got lots to talk to Howie Klein about. And I'll save it for then. I don't want to start on something now because I tend to do that. Have you noticed? I'll go off on a tangent. Anyway, I'll leave you with the news. I'll see you tomorrow. And I thank you profusely for listening and for your support. All right. Have a good night, everyone. Bye.
It's time for Nicole Sandler's What's News from NicoleSandler.com and the Progressive Voices Network.
Russian President Vladimir Putin on Tuesday broke a month-long silence on the Ukraine crisis. He accused the United States and its allies of ignoring Moscow's security concerns. Putin said the U.S. was trying to pull Russia into war as a pretext for imposing harsh sanctions to, quote, contain Russia's development. He then added that Moscow was willing to continue diplomatic talks. Well, Secretary of State Antony Blinken spoke on Tuesday with his Russian counterpart, Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov, as the U.S. awaited a response on a proposal for negotiations on trimming Russia's demands. Moscow has, of course, fueled invasion fears by positioning 100,000 troops near the border with Ukraine. They want NATO to bar Ukraine from joining the alliance and roll back its expansion in Eastern Europe. Here at home, Black History Month began on Tuesday on as ugly a note as you'd expect at a time when the party of Reagan is pushing a move toward erasing huge swaths of U.S. history, more specifically, anything dealing with slavery, or like here in Florida, anything that might make white people feel bad. Well, now 19 HBCUs, historically Black colleges and universities, received bomb threats over the last 48 hours, disrupting everything. Southern University, Spelman College, Howard University, Albany State University, Bethune-Cookman University, and Bowie State University were just some of those that received bomb threats, prompting lockdowns and shelter-in-place orders. Classes were canceled and university operations were temporarily suspended to assess the situation. The FBI and local authorities are investigating to determine the credibility of the threats. Meanwhile, students are trying to figure out how to deal with this. Here in Florida, the governor is refusing to condemn the Nazis who showed their ignorance and hate last weekend in Orlando. Instead, DeSantis is choosing to blame Democrats, accusing them of staging the demonstrations.
These Democrats who are trying to use this as some type of political issue to try to smear me as if I had something to do with it, we're not playing their game.
Opposite world indeed. On the COVID front, children younger than five here in the U.S. could soon be receiving COVID-19 vaccinations. Pfizer and BioNTech are requesting emergency use authorization for their two-dose vaccine for children aged 6 months to 5 years. They expect to complete the submission process in the next few days. It'll then be reviewed by the FDA's Vaccine Advisory Committee on February 15th. The vaccine is already authorized for use in people as young as five, and the approval would be the first COVID-19 vaccine available for the youngest children. Since the start of the pandemic, at least 11.4 million kids have tested positive for COVID-19, with over 3.5 million cases reported in January alone. Well, this is concerning. The Associated Press is reporting that Supreme Court Justice Neil Gorsuch is speaking this weekend at the Florida chapter of the Federalist Society's annual meeting, which is being held at Walt Disney World. The Federalist Society is the conservative legal group that boosted Gorsuch's Supreme Court candidacy. Gorsuch is billed as the banquet speaker on Friday, and here's the kicker. No press is allowed. Let me repeat that. No press is allowed. This two-day meeting will also feature former Vice President Mike Pence, Florida's Governor Ron DeSantis, as well as a session billed the end of Roe v. Wade that'll be moderated by a federal judge appointed by the former guy. So I ask, WTF? While they're in Florida, they should check in on the plight of the manatee. Conservation groups sued the federal government Tuesday over last year's record manatee deaths, saying the government failed to follow the law by designating protected habitat for the manatees. Hundreds of them starved to death on Florida's East Coast last year, mostly due to the loss of seagrass in the polluted Indian River Lagoon. That famine leading to a record number of deaths, with more than 1,100 dying from starvation, boat strikes, cold stress, and other causes. In other uplifting news, it's Groundhog Day. And according to tradition, we'll get 6 more weeks of winter if Punxsutawney Phil sees his shadow. Well, the rodent emerged from his hole and there was that pesky shadow. So forecasts are showing a powerful storm brewing that threatens to bring a potentially crippling combination of snow and ice across much of the country. Winter storm watches and warnings now stretch from the Mexican border to Canada, including major cities like, Chicago, St. Louis, Memphis, and Dallas. With a foot or more of snow forecast in parts of the Midwest and the Ohio Valley through tomorrow, temperatures will drop, 20 to 30 degrees below average. And finally, after almost 2 years of being called the Washington football team, after owner Dan Snyder was forced to change the 81-year-old racist moniker, they finally announced their new name Tuesday morning.
What is the new team name?
Doug, what is it?
We are the Commanders.
We are the Commanders.
The Commanders. The Washington Commanders.
That's right.
That's it? The Commanders? Isn't Commander the name of the Biden's new puppy? Way to honor the current president, Dan Snyder. Let's go, Biden. And that's just a bit of what's news for now. I'm Nicole Sandler. If you appreciate these reports and the Nicole Sandler Show, I hope you'll consider making a contribution. My work is fully listener-supported, and I can't do it without your help. Find out more at NicoleSandler.com, and please click on that donate button.